What's the first thing you're going to do when you get home after the Montana Book Festival?
I'm Maya. I'm probably going to head up to my neighbor's friend's orchard and pick plums with my children because the plums, if they're still there, need to be picked.
And I'm Margot. My husband and son are spending the weekend without me picking the rest of our apples. So I think I'm just going to take a quiet nap while they're out and before they come home.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Margot Kahn about the anthology This is the Place, Women Writing About Home, which she edited with Kelly McMasters. Also joining Margot in the studio is author and contributor Maya Jewel Zeller. This interview was made possible by the Montana Book Festival. The book is an anthology called This is the Place, Women Writing About Home. And in the introduction, you write that home is a loaded word, a complex idea. It's a place that is safe, sentimental, difficult, nourishing, war-torn, and political. What were you anticipating when you began pulling together the works, and how did the process reveal itself to be so multifaceted?
It's a great question. I think when Kelly and I began, we each had our own individual takes on the issue that were very strong, very present for us, very different, but there were certain things that we expected, especially of certain writers. For example, Amanda Petrusich is a music critic, first and foremost, although she is wildly talented in many other ways. But I expected that she would write something about music. I kind of thought maybe she'd write about her home soundtrack, or she has this incredible collection of vinyl. And that's not what she wrote about at all. She wrote this incredible environmental essay. I think we expected to receive a lot of essays about moving around a lot. It's sort of kind of a thing of our age and time. And we did receive a number of those. We also received a few essays about living in very small spaces. So there were certain things that were kind of like zeitgeisty. But I don't think we anticipated quite the amount of darkness that we got. The original title of this book was actually Wherever I'm With You. And after about the first five essays came in, we realized that title was not going to work at all.
I was really struck by the definitions of home that appeared to me like it's not only just a house, but it could be a role or a place. It could be food, pain, family, size, economics. I'm curious for both of you, what surprised you about the process of writing about home for you?
I didn't know that that the essay that I had written for this book would actually become the catalyst for a collection of essays that I'm working on. So I was surprised that the central objective correlative of the essay here, my essay, The Privilege Button, is a garage door opener. And you push the garage door opener and the garage glides open. And that seems like such an excess of privilege that we have, that I have in my life that I didn't have when I was a child. And I was kind of surprised to find that the privilege button, the notion of pushing that button, became kind of an ongoing objective correlative for me. And I'm working on new essays that interrogate privilege and poverty. And so I was surprised that I was not really writing so much about place, which is something I write about in my other work, as I was about socioeconomic status.
I think for me, I didn't expect a couple of things. One was how many people would say to me afterwards, it felt like you were in my head. I was so there, and not just people my age, but people much older than me as well. I also had a conversation with my mother and a few other women of her generation who said, you know, we felt the same way. And that made me reflect on the fact that not that much has changed, which is even more irritating, aggravating, frustrating than I felt just within my own sphere at the time of writing this piece.
I want to get into each of your individual pieces, contributions to the book a little bit later, but there was something else that came to me in the introduction where you write about home being a place where our soul belongs. And I was thinking about this phenomena of people going to places that, you know, they have no relationship to and going, oh, it felt like home. You know, I went to Stockholm and it felt like home. And I was wondering if either of you have had that sort of experience or if you've heard about it, and how do you explain the phenomenon?
I definitely did. This is Margot. It's exactly how I felt when I got to Seattle. I was in high school and I went on this crazy hiking trip in the North Cascades. And I just felt like those were my mountains. That was my place. And after the trip, we spent about 2 hours in downtown Seattle on our way back to the airport. Hadn't taken a shower in, you know, 3.5 weeks. Hadn't eaten anything really good in a while. And we sat in Pioneer Square under the pergola on a bench. And for about the whole 2 hours, I ate a slice of pizza and just watched people walk by. And I just thought, this is it. This is my place. These are my people. And Kirsten Sundberg Lundstrom has a line in her essay. She says, I feel I can be more myself here than anywhere else in the world. That's how she defines home. And that's how I feel too. The place I grew up, that I've come to appreciate in a lot of ways, just never felt quite right to me. But when I got to the mountains of Washington, I just thought, this is my place.
Just for geographic clarification, where did you come from?
I came from Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
I love that. I love the idea of the soul having a home that it's being called, you know, called to, like the notion of returning to the headwaters, right, like to where you came from. My mother was born in Des Moines, Iowa, and grew up in a family of 8 children. And her mother was a secretary and a homemaker, and her father was a trucker. And she said she never felt at home in Des Moines, Iowa. And she said she always felt wrong in her family. And then when she was in college, a friend of hers said, hey, I'm going out to the Oregon coast. Does anyone want to go? And she said, yeah, I'll come. So she took her bicycle and her backpack and she hopped in a van, a Ford van, and they came out to the Oregon coast. And she said as soon as she arrived, she said she saw the green pools and the basalt walls and the maidenhair fern. And she said, I've been missing home my entire life. And she said, that's when I knew I was home. And so then she just didn't go back to college. And she started hanging out with, you know, people in Jewel, Oregon, actually, which is where my middle name comes from and why it has 2 L's and not just one. And I was named after the small town, the small community on Highway 26, Jewel, where my uncle has a tow truck business. So, yeah, there's definitely that connection for me as well. And I have not had that same experience because I think I was born in my home, and now I live inland. And I love my inland homes, but I have never felt quite as whole there, you know, the notion of that. But I think it also happens with people. I think we find our people, and then you get, you know, you see your people after a long time and you say, this is home. These are my people. And sometimes that's your family and sometimes it's your very close friends. And for me, it's a mix of both.
You make a special note that you wanted a diverse group of voices across geography, culture, religion, age, sexuality. How did you go about getting the contributors?
Well, some people we knew. Kelly and I went to the same graduate program, although we weren't there at the same time. We didn't overlap. We had some mutual friends who we overlapped with and who introduced us, and our first books came out at the same time. So we had somewhat of a mutual sort of connection base, and we started there. Then we made a huge list of writers we admire. And we had these really big dream names and people whose work already trafficked in this idea of home in some way. As we started asking people to contribute, there were some people who were really excited and said yes right away. There were other people who were excited, but for some reason or other couldn't contribute. They were finishing their own book or starting off on a book tour. And some of those people provided names to us who we had never heard of, and some of those people wound up being amazing contributors to the book. We also put out an open call. So we sort of advertised, if you will, in a bunch of magazines where writers look to see if anyone is asking for submissions. And two of the 30 essays came out of what we refer to as the slush pile. And yeah, we just, it was that. It was sort of a little bit word of mouth and a little bit, you know, just kind of reaching out our tentacles into the writer world.
Margot, last time I saw you, you were sandwiched on a panel full of men talking about wrestling and sports. And here's a book written by women, and it covers some domestic territory too. And in your piece, you have this very telling passage. You write, "My grandmother never taught her children to cook. Women grooming their daughters to be good housewives teach them how to cook, no? A woman grooming her daughter to be something else in the world would keep her out of the kitchen." You don't have daughters, do you?
No, I don't.
What would your approach be if you had had daughters instead of sons?
Yeah, that's an amazing question. I've been baking with my son since before he could stand up. I would sit him on the floor, and we have some great pictures of us baking on the kitchen floor. In fact, my husband took a video at one point where, you know, the flour was sort of scattered all over the floor, and I just scooped it up with my hands and put it in the bowl. And then I realized he was taping us, and I laughed and said, "I guess no one is ever going to eat anything that comes out of this kitchen ever again." But it's very important to me that my son knows how to cook and how to bake and how to get around the kitchen. And my husband's actually a wonderful cook too. If I had daughters, I still think I would want to cook and bake with them because food is a huge part of our family life. And we grow a lot of our own food. We have an orchard and we spend a lot of our time doing food things, although my husband is really the primary canner, the maker of the ketchup and the salsa and the canned peaches and all the things. But if I had a daughter, you know, I would want her to make sure she knew what her options were. And of course, that kind of education goes far beyond what happens in the kitchen and what happens at home.
Will you read a section from your essay?
Sure. The title homemaker is not something I will put on my resume. And yet, in the quotidian handiwork, handwork, hands-on work of making a home for my family, I find there is creativity and sometimes satisfaction. There is a necessary commitment to the space and time each task requires, sweeping the floor, changing the sheets, folding the towels, sorting silverware, watering plants, hanging a picture. Each motion a ritual, an act of devotion. It feels good to be nurtured, and it feels good to nurture my child, my partner, the house plants, even the physical structure of windows, decking, pipes, and wires. So this is the paradox of modern homemaking that I cannot resolve, I can only frame. There is a beauty, a necessity in the making of a space where we are safe and comforted, a place that reflects who we are and what we hold dear. And there is the mundane drudgery of the daily tasks this requires. But while a woman with a corporate job and board positions who farms out her household tasks to nannies, decorators, cleaners, and gardeners is regarded as powerful and successful, a woman who cares for her home and raises her children is seen as what? I have trouble even finishing the sentence. There is a void here, as if irrelevant, though irrelevant isn't the right word, but it is an empty space, a space unseen.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Margot Kahn and Maya Jewel Zeller about the anthology This is the Place, Women Writing About Home. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In the biography of your book, Margot, you make a note
about you living in Washington State, which passed the most progressive family leave policy in 2017. What can you say about the relationship between family leave policy and a sense of home?
Well, I feel really strongly that the choice to stay home is a really wonderful one. I am so lucky, so privileged to have had the choice, the opportunity to stay home and be with my baby, who I really wanted. He's my only child, and I wanted to be there for him. He was really unhappy going to nursery school, or, you know, what we call preschool, which is really daycare. And he really wanted to be home, and I wanted to be home with him. That said, it's only a choice if it is a fair choice. And the only way staying home is a fair choice is if a woman has her job to return to, if she is not docked pay for that time that she's gone. And so the law that Washington State passed, we're only one of five states in the country, which is really unbelievable to have this policy, and ours is the most progressive of anywhere, guarantees women 3 months of paid leave or primary caregiver. It's been shown when companies, if individual companies, of course, have different policies, and there are many, you can Google, you know, top 10 best companies for family leave. But when Google increased their family leave by just a few months, the rate of women quitting after having a baby dropped by 50%. So I think it's very telling that having this choice, a fair choice, being able to have a job to return to, not losing pay, allows women to really decide on a fair basis.
Maya, the organizing principle of your essay called the privilege button belongs to your neighborhood's homeowners association regulations. How did you know this would be the scaffolding?
So I had been working, actually writing poetry quite a bit when I was working on this essay. And so the poetic form often lends itself to lyric structures and forms that impose upon content. And I had also been reading Eula Biss, and she has this essay called The Pain Scale. And so I was kind of working in these lyric hermit crab, you know, Brenda Miller and Suzanne Pale call it the hermit crab essay. And my husband had recently become the HOA president when I was working on the essay. And so I was really just kind of drawn to those covenants because I found them humorous and I found them to be in direct conflict or juxtaposition with the work that I was writing. And so I thought that natural juxtaposition between the covenants and what I think is semi-serious but also humorous material just made for a good form.
Will you read one of the covenants in your response?
Yeah, so I'll read from the start of the privilege button. And the first protective covenant for Fairwood Park 2 HOA Article 2 Protective Covenants Section 2.04, temporary structures, no trailer, basement, tent, shack, garage, barn, camper, or other outbuilding or any structure of temporary character erected or placed on the property shall at any time be used as a residence. And then the essay begins after that first covenant, and then they're woven through. For 9 years, my husband and I lived in a beautiful turn-of-the-century four-bedroom house on North Jefferson Street near West Central Spokane. We pulled as many weeds as we could work out of the cracks between the rocks, planted perennials, lilacs, phlox. We put plastic on our windows to help keep out the cold in winter, and when the temperature dropped into the negatives for over a week, we used a hairdryer to thaw the pipes that ran too close to the uninsulated wall in the basement. We tried wrapping them, too, but it seemed their freezing was a condition of their location, of the old foundation. There were things about the house that we couldn't fix, and we loved it for its imperfection, for its charm. I always felt rich in this house, the first I'd owned. When we took out a loan for $100,000 in 2005, I thought we'd spent a fortune. We were homeowners, or at least our payments each month went towards something we might get to keep. When I was growing up, my parents were renters, even squatters. Sometimes we lived in a garage. Sometimes we lived in a van. When I repeated this to my husband years into marriage, he shook his head and said, with a realization I hadn't reached, "Maya, you were homeless." I had never thought of myself as homeless. Itinerant, maybe. Gypsy, sure. I didn't yet know the term's problematic usage. Not homeless. More like a mouse after a flood, finding a new place for its nest. No, our friend Joe was homeless. He tracked us down each Thanksgiving and gorged himself on the salmon my brother caught. He bummed a joint from my dad, took a shower if we had one. Joe was homeless. Sometimes he had a car, sometimes he didn't. When he did, it was full of his stuff. But we always had a roof of some sort. We always had access to natural spaces, a benefit often ignored as a privilege of those in rural poverty. We didn't always have a bathroom or running water, but we always had a roof, a basin, a wood stove. We went to school, usually. I don't remember being hungry for more than a few days at a time. My mother used to sing Cher's Gypsies, Tramps, and Thieves while she darned our socks, and my father hummed King of the Road when he was only 2 beers into the night and still feeling jolly. When my father occasionally took up driving a tow truck, our homes were surrounded by cars in the bushes, treasure troves where we might find free cassette tapes, t-shirts. They were playhouses, magic passageways to other lives and times. We weren't homeless.
Your work negotiates a complex relationship between poverty and privilege. And I'm just wondering, how does it feel like it's integrating for you today?
In my life now? I mean, I think that when you're working in a binary like poverty and privilege, it's easy to fall into that false dichotomy. And I think that it's too easy for us to say, oh, I have all this privilege because I have all these things and I have all these material possessions. And I don't think that material possessions always equal privilege. I think that there's absolutely a poverty in that privilege, a poverty of, you know, becoming a slave to the clock or, you know, the golden handcuffs or the notion of I have to hurry and I have to do the next thing and I have to, you know, check off the boxes. And there's absolutely, you know, as Henry David Thoreau would have said, or as Annie Dillard would say, or as so many people would say, there's a beauty or a healthy simplicity, you know, to cultivate a healthy poverty. And I think that that connection to, you know, being able to go take a walk by the Clark Fork while I'm here instead of just sitting inside and having conversations, that's a privilege that I don't take lightly. And I think as I'm working in this dichotomy, it's always important for me to keep reminding myself what privilege really means to me. And it's not the material possessions that I have gained, and that's not the privilege that I still seek.
In addition to your essays, there were two pieces that really stood out to me. One is Danielle Geller's called Annotating the First Page of the First Navajo English Dictionary. And it's a profound and deeply personal account set to an unfolding dictionary of language. What was your reaction or response to reading her work?
Danielle's essay is so different from all the other essays in this collection and really from all the other essays I think I've ever read. The way she uses a language that I've not been exposed to and then weaves her own experience into its vocabulary was so gorgeous and so difficult, but she is really just bracingly honest and raw in that piece. And I think what is so beautiful about it is there's so much self-discovery in the writing itself.
The other piece is by Deborah Gwartney called Broken Home, in which she catalogs the abuse and violation of a family's privacy. And one of the sentences she writes is, "My daughters no longer believed I could keep them safe." How does safety relate to a sense of home? And what do you think happens to a sense of home when it becomes so charged?
Safety is a notion that ran through so many essays in this book and really made us pause to think more deeply about it. I think some people take that notion for granted, if that's all they've ever experienced. But so many people have experienced a different reality. And I think the idea that home is a place where, again, as Kirsten said, I can feel more myself than anywhere else, safety is somehow inherent to that notion. If you can really let down your guard, what you're saying or asking is to feel safe, to be made to feel safe in that space. Deborah's essay is so difficult, and I have some regrets now about putting it so far forward in the collection, and yet it was one of the pieces that just blew me away, still blows me away, again with its honesty, its rawness, and its deep questions about what is important about home.
I'm going to pivot to a lighter note. Singer-songwriter Sean Colvin blurbs the book, and I was just fooling around on the internet looking at Sean Colvin, and I found her covering the Talking Heads' This Must Be the Place. And I know in the acknowledgments, Margot, you mentioned that your son came up with a title, so I just want to know, what's the musical lineage of this title?
Well, when we realized we couldn't call the book Wherever I'm With You, we were on the hunt for a new title. And we had a few contenders, and one of those contenders was This Must Be the Place. But then we realized we were going to have to pay the Talking Heads to use that title. And someone had titled their novel This Must Be the Place just the year before this book came out, which we didn't know at the time. So we took a poll. We've talked to so many people. We talked to judges from the National Book Critics Circle Award. We talked to our agent. We talked to all our writer friends. We were having the hardest time figuring out what the title should be. And of the three contenders that we had, everyone was split evenly, a third, a third, and a third. So finally, I was explaining this dilemma. We had to choose the title. The thing had to go to print. And we were driving in the car. I was with my husband and my son. And my son piped up from the back and he said, "Well, I like This Must Be the Place the best. That is definitely the best title." He was really emphatic about it. And I said, "Well, here's the problem." And I explained the problem. And he was quiet for about 30 seconds. And then he said, "Well, why don't you just call it This Is the Place?" And I really, my jaw kind of dropped. And I just thought, of all the people we asked, no one could figure that out. He was, I think, 5 at the time. So that was it. It was just super obvious in that moment. And the thing that I love about the title is it can refer to anything. This is the place is what you say when you finally find the place you're looking for, like I was today coming to this interview. You also say it in any kind of story, like, "This is the place I had my first kiss. This is the place I ran away from. This is the place where such and such happened, good or bad." It's sort of a memory trigger and a defining phrase.
Margot Kahn lives in Seattle and is the author of the biography Horses That Buck. Maya Jewel Zeller lives in Eastern Washington, where she's a writer, editor, and educator. Look for more information about their work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Bo Baker, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org.